Part 1. Storms. Maris rode the storm 10 feet above the sea, taming the winds on wide cloth-of-metal wings. She flew fiercely, recklessly, delighting in the danger and the feel of the spray, not bothered by the cold. The sky was an ominous cobalt blue. The winds were building, and she had wings. That was enough. She could die now and die happy, flying. She flew better than she ever had before, twisting and gliding between the air currents without thought, catching each time the updraft or downwind that would carry her farther or faster. She made no wrong choices, was forced into no hasty scrambles above the leaping ocean. The tacking she did was all for joy. It would have been safer to fly high like a child, up above the waves as far as she could climb, safe from her own mistakes. But Maris skimmed the sea like a flyer, where a single dip, a brush of wing against water, meant a clumsy tumble from the sky, and death. You don't swim far when your wingspan is 20 feet. Maris was daring, but she knew the winds. Ahead, she spied the neck of a scilla, a sinuous rope dark against the horizon. Almost without thinking, she responded. Her right hand pulled down on the leather wing grip, her left pushed up. She shifted the whole weight of her body. The great silver wings, tissue-thin and almost weightless but immensely strong, shifted with her, turning. One wingtip all but grazed the white cap snapping below. The other lifted. Maris caught the rising winds more fully and began to climb. Death, sky death, had been on her mind. But she would not end like that, snapped from the air like an unwary gull, lunch for a hungry monster. Minutes later she caught up to the scilla and paused for a taunting circle just beyond its reach. From above she could see its body, barely beneath the waves, the rows of slick black flippers beating rhythmically, the tiny head, swaying slowly from side to side atop the long neck, ignored her. Perhaps it has known flyers, she thought then, and it does not like the taste. The winds were colder now, and heavy with salt. The storm was gathering strength. She could feel a trembling in the air. Maris, exhilarated, soon left the scilla far behind. Then she was alone again, flying effortlessly through an empty, darkening world of sea and sky, where the only sound was the wind upon her wings. In time, the island reared out of the sea, her destination. Sighing, sorry for the journey's end, Maris let herself descend. Gina and Tor, two of the local landbound, Maris didn't know what they did when they weren't caring for visiting flyers, were on duty out on the landing spit. She circled once above them to catch their attention. They rose from the soft sand and waved at her. The second time she came around, they were ready. Maris dipped lower and lower until her feet were just inches above the ground. Gina and Tor ran across the sand parallel to her, each beside a wing. Her toes brushed surface, and she began to slow in a shower of sand. Finally she stopped, lying prone on the cool, dry sand. She felt silly. A downed flyer is like a turtle on its back. She could get on her feet if she had to, but it was a difficult, undignified process. Still, it had been a good landing. Gina and Tor began to fold up her wings, joint by foot-long joint. As each strut unlocked and folded back on the next segment, the tissue fabric between them went limp. When all the extensors were pulled in, the wings hung in two loose folds of drooping metal from the central axis strapped to Maris's back. "We'd expected coal," said Gina, as she folded back the final strut. Her short dark hair stood out in spikes around her face. Maris shook her head. It should have been Cole's journey, perhaps, but she had been desperate, longing for the air. She'd taken the wings, still her wings, and gone before he was out of bed. "He'll have flying enough after next week, I expect," Tor said cheerfully. There was still sand in his lank blonde hair, and he was shivering a little from the sea winds, but he smiled as he spoke. "All the flying he'll want." He stepped in front of Maris to help her unstrap the wings. "I'll wear them," Maris snapped at him, impatient, angered by his casual words. How could he understand? How could any of them understand? They were land-bound. She started up the spit toward the lodge, Gina and Tor falling in beside her. There she took the usual refreshments, and standing before a huge open fire, allowed herself to be dried and warmed. The friendly questions she answered curtly, trying to be silent, trying not to think this may be the last time. Because she was a flyer, they all respected her silence, though with disappointment. For the landbound, the flyers were the most regular source of contact with the other islands. The seas, daily storm-lashed and infested with scillas and sea-cats and other predators, were too dangerous for regular ship travel, except among islands within the same local group. The flyers were the links, and the others looked to them for news, gossip, songs, stories, romance. "The landsman will be ready whenever you're rested," Gina said, touching Maris tentatively on the shoulder. Maris pulled away, thinking, "Yes, to you it is enough to serve the flyers. You'd like a flyer husband. Cole, perhaps, when he's grown, and you don't know what it means to me that Cole should be the flyer and not I." But she said only, "I'm ready now. It was an easy flight. The winds did all the work." Gina led her to another room, where the landsman was waiting for her message. Like the first room, this was long and sparsely furnished, with a blazing fire crackling in a great stone hearth. The landsman sat in a cushioned chair near the flames. He rose when Maris entered. Flyers were always greeted as equals, even on islands where the landsmen were worshipped as gods and held godlike powers. After the ritual greetings had been exchanged, Maris closed her eyes and let the message flow. She didn't know or care what she said. The words used her voice, without troubling her conscious thought. Probably politics, she thought. Lately it had all been politics. When the message ended, Maris opened her eyes and smiled at the landsman, perversely, on purpose, because he looked worried by her words. But he recovered quickly and returned her smile.
"Thank you," he said a little weakly. "You've done well."
She was invited to stay the night, but she refused. The storm might die by morning. Besides, she liked night flying. Tor and Gina accompanied her outside and up the rocky path to the flyer's cliff. There were lanterns set in the stone every few feet to make the twisting ascent safer at night. At the top of the climb was a natural ledge, made deeper and wider by human hands. Beyond it, an 80-foot drop and breakers crashing on a rocky beach. On the ledge, Gina and Tor unfolded her wings and locked the struts in place, and the tissue metal stretched tight and taut and silvery. And Maris jumped. The wind caught her, lifted. She was flying again, dark sea below and rumbling storm above. Once launched, she never looked back at the two wistful landbound following her with their eyes. Too soon she would be one of them. She did not turn toward home. Instead, she flew with the storm winds blowing violently now, westerly. Soon the thunder would come and rain, and then Maris would be forced up above the clouds, where the lightning was less likely to burn her from the sky. At home it would be calm, the storm passed. People would be out beach-combing to see what the winds had brought, and a few small dories might be casting off in the hope that a day's fishing might not be entirely lost. The wind sang in her eyes and pushed at her, and she swam in the sky stream gracefully. Then, oddly, she thought of Cole. and suddenly she lost the feel. She wavered, dipped, and pulled herself up, sharply, tacking, searching for it, and cursing herself. It had been so good before. Did it have to end this way? This might be her last flight ever, and it had to be her best. But it was no use. She'd lost the certainty. The wind and she were no longer lovers. She began to fly at cross purposes to the storm, battling grimly, fighting until her muscles were strained and aching. She gained altitude now. Once the wind feel left you, it was not safe to fly so near the water. She was exhausted, tired of fighting. When she caught sight of the rocky face of the Eyrie and realized how far she had come. The Eyrie was nothing but a huge rock thrust up from the sea, a crumbling tower of stone surrounded by an angry froth where the waters broke against its tall, sheer walls. It was not an island. Nothing would grow here but pockets of tough lichen. Birds made their nests in the few protected crevices and ledges, though, and atop the rock the flyers had built their nest. Here, where no ship could moor, here where no one but flyers, bird and human, could roost, here stood their dark stone lodge. Maris! She looked up at the sound of her name and saw Dorrel diving on her, laughing, his wings dark against the clouds. At the last possible moment she turned from him, banking sharply, and slipped out from under his dive. He chased her around the Eyrie, and Maris forgot that she was tired and aching, and lost herself in the sheer joy of flying. When at last they landed, the rains had just begun, howling suddenly from the east, stinging their faces and slapping hard against their wings. Maris realized that she was nearly numb with cold. They came down in a soft earth landing pit, carved in the solid rock, without help, and Maris slid 10 feet in sudden mud before coming to a stop. Then it took her 5 minutes to find her feet and fumble with the triple straps that wrapped around her body. She tied the wings carefully to a tether rope, then walked out to a wingtip and began to fold them up. By the time she had finished, her teeth were chattering convulsively, and she could feel the soreness in her arms. Dorrel frowned as he watched her work. His own wings, neatly folded, were slung over his shoulder. "Had you been out long?" he asked. "I should have let you land. I'm sorry, I didn't realize. You must have been with the storm all the way, just in front of it. Difficult weather. I got some of the crosswinds myself. Are you all right?" "Oh, yes. I was tired, but not really, not now. I'm glad you were there to meet me. That was good flying, and I needed it. The last part of the trip was rough. I thought I would drop, but good flying's better than rest." Dorrel laughed and put his arm around her. She felt how warm he was after the flight, and by contrast how cold she was. He felt it too and squeezed her tighter. "Come inside before you freeze. Garth brought some bottles of kivas from the Shotans, and one of them should be hot by now. Between us and the kivas we'll get you warm again." The common room of the lodge was warm and cheerful as always, but almost empty. Garth, a short, well-muscled flyer 10 years her senior, was the only one there. He looked up from his place by the fire and called them by name. Maris wanted to answer, but her throat was tight with longing, and her teeth were clenched together. Dorrel led her to the fireplace.
"Like a wood-winged idiot, I kept her out in the cold," Dorrel said. "Is the kivas hot? Pour us some."
He stripped off his wet, muddy clothes quickly and efficiently and pulled 2 large towels from a pile near the fire.
"Why should I waste my kivas on you?" Garth rumbled. "For Maris, of course, for she's very beautiful and a superb flyer."
He made a mock bow in her direction.
"You should waste your kivas on me," Dorrel said, rubbing himself briskly with a big towel, "unless you would care to waste it all over the floor."
Garth replied, and they traded insults and threats in laconic voices. Maris didn't listen. She'd heard it all before. She squeezed the water from her hair, watching the patterns the wetness made on the half-stones, and how quickly they faded. She looked at Doral, trying to memorize his lean, muscular body, a good flyer's body, and the quick changes of his face as he teased Garth. But he turned when he felt Maris watching him, and his eyes gentled. Garth's final witticism fell limply into silence. Doral touched Maris softly, tracing the line of her jaw.
"You're still shivering."
He took the towel from her hands and wrapped it around her. "Garth, take that bottle off the fire before it explodes and let us all get warm." The kivas, a hot spice wine flavoured with raisins and nuts, was served in great stone mugs. The first sip sent thin lines of fire down her veins, and the shivering stopped.
Garth smiled at her. "Good, isn't it? Not that Doral will appreciate it. I tricked a slimy old fisherman out of a dozen bottles. He found it in a shipwreck, didn't know what he had, and his wife didn't want it in the house. I gave him some trinkets for it, some metal beads I'd picked up for my sister."
"And what does your sister get?" Maris asked, between sips of kivas.
Garth shrugged. "Her? Oh, it was a surprise anyway. I'll bring something from Poe the next time I go. Some painted eggs."
"If he doesn't see something else he can trade them for on his way back," Doral said. "If your sister ever gets a surprise, Garth, the shock will kill all pleasure. You were born a trader. I think you'd swap your wings if the deal was good enough."
Garth snorted indignantly.
"Close your mouth when you say that, bird."
He turned to Maris.
"How is your brother? I never see him."
Maris took another sip of her drink, holding on to calm with both hands. "He'll be of age next week," she said carefully. "The wings will be his then. I wouldn't know about his comings and goings. Maybe he doesn't like your company."
"Huh," said Garth. "Why shouldn't he?"
He sounded wounded. Maris waved a hand and forced herself to smile. She'd meant it lightly.
"I like him well enough," Garth went on. "We all like him, don't we, Doral? He's young, quiet, maybe a bit too cautious, but he should improve. He's different somehow." "Oh, but he can tell some stories. And sing. The landbird will learn to love the sight of his wings."
Garth shook his head in wonder.
"Where does he learn them all? I've done more travelling than he has, but..."
"He makes them up," said Maris.
"Himself?" Garth was impressed. "He'll be our singer, then. We'll take the prize away from Eastern at the next competition. Western always has the best flyers," he said loyally, "but our singers have never been worthy of the title." "I sang for Western at the last meet," Doral objected. "That's what I mean."
"You shriek like a sea cat."
"Yes," said Garth, "but I have no delusions about my ability."
Maris missed Doral's reply. Her mind had drifted away from their dialogue, and she was watching the flames, thinking, nursing her still warm drink. She felt peaceful here in the Eyrie, even now, even after Garth had mentioned coal, and strangely comfortable. No one lived on the Flyer's Rock, but it was a home of sorts. Her home. It was hard to think of not coming here any more. She remembered the first time she'd seen the Eyrie, a good 6 years ago, just after her coming-of-age day. She'd been a girl of 13, proud of having flown so far alone, but scared too, and shy. Inside the lodge she'd found a dozen flyers sitting around a fire, drinking, laughing. A party was in progress, but they'd stopped and smiled at her. Garth had been a quiet youth then, Doral a skinny boy just barely older than she. She hadn't known either of them. But Helmer, a middle-aged flyer from the island closest to hers, had been among the company, and he made the introductions. Even now she remembered the faces, the names. Red-headed Annie from Cullhall, Foster, who later grew too fat to fly, Jameis the Senior, and especially the one nicknamed Raven, an arrogant youth who dressed in black fur and metal and had won awards for Eastern in 3 straight competitions. There was another too, a lanky blonde from the Outer Islands. The party was in her honour. It was seldom any of the outers flew so very, very far. They'd all welcomed Maris, and soon it seemed almost as if she'd replaced the tall blonde as the guest of honour. They gave her wine, despite her age, and made her sing with them, and told her stories about flying, most of which she'd heard before, but never from such as these. Finally, when she felt very much part of the group, they let their attentions wander from her, and the festivities resumed their normal course. It had been a strange, unforgettable party, and one incident in particular was burned golden in her memory. Raven, the only eastern wing in the group, had been taking a lot of needling. Finally, a little drunk, he rebelled. "You call yourselves flyers," he'd said, in a whiplash voice that Maris would always recall. "Come, come with me, I'll show you flying." And the whole party had gone outside to the Flyers' Cliff of the Eyrie, the highest cliff of all. 600 feet straight down it plunged, to where the rocks stood up like teeth, and the water churned furiously against them. Raven, wearing folded wings, walked up to the brink. He unfolded the first 3 joints of his wing struts carefully, and slid his arms through the loops. But he did not lock the wings. The hinges still moved, and the open struts bent back and forth with his arms, flexible. The other struts he held, folded, in his hands. Maris had wondered what he was up to. She soon found out. He ran and jumped, out as far as he could, off the Flyer's Cliff, with his wings still folded. She gasped, run to the edge. The others followed, some looking pale, a few grinning. Doral had stood beside her. Raven was falling straight down a rock, his hands at his sides, his wing cloth flapping like a cape. Head first he flew, and the plunge seemed to last forever. Then, at the very last moment, when he was almost on the rocks, when Maris could almost feel the impact, silver wings suddenly flashing in the sunlight, wings from nowhere, and Raven caught the winds and flew. Maris had been awed, but Jamis the senior, the oldest flyer Weston had, only laughed.
"Raven's trick," he growled. "I've seen him do it twice before. He oils his wing struts. After he's fallen far enough, he flings them away as hard as he can. As each one locks in place, the snap flings loose the next one. Pretty, yes. You can bet he practiced it plenty before he tried it out in front of anyone. One of these days, though, a hinge is going to jam, and we won't have to listen to Raven any more."
But even his words hadn't tarnished the magic. Maris often had seen flyers impatient with their land-bound help draw their almost open wings up and shake out the last joint or two with a sharp snap, but never anything like this. Raven had been smirking when he met them at the landing pit. "When you can do that," he told the company, "then you can call yourselves flyers." He'd been a conceited, reckless sort, yes, but right at that moment, and for years afterward, Maris had thought herself in love with him. She shook her head sadly and finished her kivas. It all seemed silly now. Raven had died less than 2 years after that party, vanished at sea without a trace. A dozen flyers died each year, and their wings usually were lost with them. Clumsy flying would down and drown them. Long-necked scillers had been known to attack unwary skimmers. Storms could blow them from the sky. Lightning hunted out the metal of their wings. Yes, there were many ways a flyer could die. Most of them, Maris suspected, just lost their way and missed their destinations, flying on blindly till exhaustion pulled them down. A few perhaps hit that rarest and most feared menace of the sky, still air. But Maris knew now that Raven had been a more likely candidate for death than most, a foolish, flashy flyer with no sky sense. Doral's voice jarred her from her memories. "Maris," he said, "hey, don't go to sleep on us." Maris set down her empty cup, her hand curved around the rough stone, still seeking the warmth it had held. With an effort, she pulled her hand away and picked up her sweater.
"It's not dry,"
Garth protested. "Are you cold?" asked Dorrel. "No, I must get back."
"You're too tired," Dorrel said. "Stay the night."
Maris drew her eyes away from his. "I mustn't. They'll worry." Dorrel sighed.
"Then take dry clothes."
He stood, went to the far end of the common room, and pulled open the doors of a carved wooden wardrobe.
"Come here and pick out something that fits."
Maris did not move.
"I'd better take my own clothes. I won't be coming back."
Dorrel swore softly.
"Maris, don't make things... You know that... Oh, come, take the clothes. You're welcome to them, you know that. Leave yours in exchange, if you like. I won't let you go out in wet clothes."
"I'm sorry," Maris said. Garth smiled at her while Dorrel stood waiting. She got up slowly, pulling the towel more closely around her as she moved away from the fire. The ends of her short, dark hair felt damp and cold against her neck. With Dorrel, she searched through the piles of clothes until she found trousers and a brown woolweed sweater to fit her slender, wiry frame. Dorrel watched her dress, then quickly found clothes for himself. Then they went to the rack near the door and took down their wings. Maris ran her long, strong fingers over the struts for weakness or damage. The wings seldom failed, but when they did, the trouble was always in the joints. The fabric itself shone as soft and strong as it had when the star sailors rowed it to this world. Satisfied, Maris strapped on the wings. They were in good shape. Col would wear them for years, and his children for generations after him. Garth had come to stand beside her. She looked at him.
"I'm not so good at words as Col is, or Dorrel," he started. Goodbye, Maris."
He blushed, looking miserable. Flyers did not say goodbye to each other. "But I am not a flyer," she thought. And so she hugged Garth and kissed him and said goodbye, the word of the land bound. Dorrel walked outside with her. The winds were strong, as always around the Eyrie, but the storm had passed. The only water in the air was the faint mist of sea spray. But the stars were out.
"At least stay for dinner," Dorrel said. "Garth and I would fight for the pleasure of serving you."
Maris shook her head. She shouldn't have come. She should have flown straight home and never said goodbye to Garth or Dorrel. Easier not to make the ending. Easier to pretend that things would always be the same and then to vanish at the end. When they reached the High Flyer's Cliff, the same from where Raven had leapt so long ago, she reached for Dorrel's hand, and they stood a while longer in silence. "Maris," he said finally, hesitantly. He looked straight out to sea, standing by her side, holding her hand.
"Maris, you could marry me. I would share my wings with you. You needn't give up flying entirely."
Maris dropped his hand and felt herself go hot all over with shame. He had no right. It was cruel to pretend.
"Don't," she said in a whisper. "The wings aren't yours to share." "Tradition," he said, sounding desperate. She could tell he was embarrassed also. He wanted to help her, not to make things worse. "We could try it. The wings are mine, but you could use them. Oh, Dorrel, don't. The landsman, your landsman, would never allow it. It's more than tradition, it's law. They might take your wings away and give them to someone with more respect, like they did to Lind, the smuggler. Besides, even if we ran away, to a place without law or landsmen, to a place by ourselves, how long could you bear to share your wings? With me? With anyone? Don't you see? We'd come to hate one another. I'm not a child who can practice when you're resting. I can't live like that, flying on sufferance, knowing the wings could never be mine. And you would grow tired of the way I would watch you. We would... Oh." She broke off, fumbling for words. Dorrel was silent for a moment. "I'm sorry," he said. "I wanted to do something to help you, Maris.
It hurts unbearably knowing what is about to happen to you. I wanted to give you something. I can't bear to think of your going away and becoming...
She took his hand again and held it tightly. Yes, yes.
Shh. You do know I love you, Maris. You do, don't you?
Yes. Yes. And I love you, Doral. But I'll never marry a flyer, not now. I couldn't. I'd murder him for his wings.
She looked at him, trying to lighten the bleak truth of her words, and failing.
They clung to each other, balanced on the edge of the moment of parting, trying to say now, with the pressure of their bodies, everything they might ever want to say to each other. Then they pulled away, and looked at each other through tears. Maris fumbled with her wings, shaking, suddenly cold again. Doral tried to help, but his fingers collided with hers, and they laughed, haltingly, at their clumsiness. She let him unfold her wings for her. When one of them was fully extended, and the second nearly so, she suddenly thought of Raven, and waved Doral away. Puzzled, he watched. Maris lifted the wing like an air-weary elder, and threw the final joint into lock with a clean, strong snap, and then she was ready to leave.
"Go well," he said finally.
Maris opened her mouth, then closed it, nodding foolishly.
"And you," she said at last.
"Take care until..."
But she could not add the final lie, any more than she could say goodbye to him. She turned and ran from him, and launched herself away from the eyrie, out on the night winds, into a cold, dark sky. It was a long and lonely flight over a starlit sea, where nothing stirred. The winds were steady from the east, forcing Maris to tack all the way, losing time and speed. By the time she spotted the light tower of Lesser Amberley, her home island, midnight had come and gone. There was another light below, turning on their landing beach. She saw it as she coasted in, smooth and easy, and thought it must be the lodgemen. But they should have gone off duty long ago. Few flyers were aloft this late. She frowned in puzzlement just as she hit the ground with a jarring shock. Maris groaned, hurried to get up, and set to work on the wing straps. She should know enough not to be distracted at the moment of landing. The light advanced on her.
"So you decided to come back," the voice said, harsh and angry.
It was Russ, her father, stepfather really, coming toward her with a lantern in his good hand, his right arm hanging dead and useless at his side.
"I stopped by the eyrie first," she said defensively. "You weren't worried?"
"Cole was to go, not you."
The lines of his face were set hard. "He was in bed," Maris said. "He was too slow. I knew he'd miss the best of the storm winds. He would have caught nothing but rain, and it would have taken him forever to get there, if he did. He's not good in rain yet."
"Then he must learn to be better. The boy must make his own mistakes now. You were his teacher, but soon the wings will be his. He's the flyer, not you."
Maris winced as if struck. This was the man who had taught her to fly, who had been so proud of her, and the way she seemed to know instinctively what to do. The wings would be hers, he'd told her more than once, though she was not of his blood. He and his wife had taken her in when it seemed that he would never father a child of his own to inherit the wings. He'd had his accident and lost the sky, and it was important to find a flyer to replace him. If not someone of his blood, then someone he loved. His wife had refused to learn. She'd lived 35 years as a landbound, and she did not intend to jump off any cliffs, wings or no. Besides, it was too late. Flyers had to be taught young. So it was Maris he had taught, adopted, and come to love. Maris, the fisherman's daughter, who would rather watch from the flyer's cliff than play with the other children. And then, against all probability, Cole had been born. His mother had died after the prolonged and difficult labour. Maris, very much a child, remembered a dark night full of people running, and later her stepfather crying alone in a corner. But Cole had lived on. Maris, suddenly a child mother, came to care for him, love him. At first they didn't expect him to live. She was happy when he did, and for 3 years she loved him as both brother and son, while she practiced with the wings under their father's watchful eyes. Until the night when the same father told her that Cole, baby Cole, must have her wings.
"I'm a far better flyer than he will ever be," Maris told him now on the beach, her voice trembling. "I do not dispute that. It makes no difference. He's my own blood." "It's not fair," she cried, letting out the protest that had been lodged inside her since the day she'd come of age. By then, Col had been strong, healthy, still too small to bear the wings, but they would be his on his coming-of-age day. Maris had no claim, no right at all. That was the law of the flyers, stretching back through generations to the star sailors themselves, the legendary wing-forgers. The first-born child of each of the flying families would inherit the wings of the parent. Skill counted for nothing. This was a law of inheritance, and Maris came from a fishing family who had nothing to leave her but the scattered wreckage of a wooden boat.
"Fair or no, it is the law, Maris. You've known it for a long time, even if you chose to ignore it. For years you've played at being a flyer, and I've let you because you loved it, and because Col needed a teacher, a skilled one, and because this island is too big to rely on only two flyers, but you knew all the while this day would come."
He could be more kind, she thought wildly. He must know what it means to give up the sky.
"Now come with me," he said. "You'll not fly again."
Her wings were still fully extended. Only one strap was undone.
"I'll run away," she said madly. "You'll never see me again. I'll go to some island where they don't have a flyer of their own. They'll be glad to have me, no matter how I got my wings."
"Never," her father said sadly. "The other flyers would shun the island, as they did after the mad landsman of Kennahut executed the flyer who brought bad news. You would be stripped of your stolen wings no matter where you went. No landsman would take the risk."
"I'll break them then," Maris said, riding the edge of hysteria. "Then he'll never fly either, any more than...
Glass shattered on rock, and the light went out as her father dropped the lantern. Maris felt his grip on her hands.
"You couldn't, even if you wanted to. And you wouldn't do that to Col. But give me the wings."
"I wouldn't. I don't know what you wouldn't do. I thought you'd gone out to kill yourself this morning, to die flying in the storm."
"I know the feelings, Maris. That's why I was so frightened and so angry. You mustn't blame Col."
"I don't. And I would not keep him from flying. But I want to fly so badly myself, Father. Please."
Tears ran down her face in the dark, and she moved closer, reaching for comfort.
"Yes, Maris," he said.
He could not put his arm about her. The wings got in the way.
"There's nothing I can do. This is the way of things. You must learn to live without wings as I have. At least you've had them for a time. You know what it's like to fly."
"It's not enough," she said, tearful, stubborn. "I used to think it would be when I was a little girl. Not even yours yet, just a stranger. And you were Amberley's greatest flyer. I watched you and the others from the cliff, and I used to think, if I could have wings, even for a moment, that would be life enough. But it isn't, it isn't. I can't give them up."
The hard lines were all gone now in her father's face. He touched her face gently, brushing away tears.
"Perhaps you're right," he said, in a slow, heavy voice. "Perhaps it was not a good thing. I thought if I could let you fly for a while, a little bit, that would be better than nothing. It would be a fine, bright gift indeed. But it wasn't, was it? Now you can never be happy. You can never be a landbound, really, for you've flown, and you'll always know how you are imprisoned."
His words stopped abruptly, and Maris realized that he was talking of himself as much as her. He helped her unstrap and fold the wings, and they walked back home together. Their house was a simple wood frame surrounded by trees and land. A creek ran through the back. Flyers could live well. Russ said good night just inside the door and took the wings upstairs with him. Has he really lost all trust? Maris thought. What have I done? And she felt like crying again. Instead, she wandered into the kitchen, found cheese and cold meat and tea, and took them back into the dining room. A bowl-shaped sand candle sat in the centre of the table. She lit it, ate, and watched the flame dance. Cole entered, just as she finished, and stood awkwardly in the doorway. "Law, Maris," he said uncertainly. "I'm glad you're back. I was waiting." He was tall for a 13-year-old, with a soft, slender body, long red-blonde hair, and the wispy beginnings of a moustache. "Lo, Cole," Maris said. "Don't just stand there. I'm sorry I took the wings." He sat down. "I don't mind, you know that. You fly a lot better than me. And, well, you know." "Was Father mad?" Maris nodded. Cole looked grim and frightened. "It's only 1 week away now, Maris. What are we going to do?" He was looking straight down at the candle, not at her. Maris sighed and put a gentle hand on his arm. "We'll do what we must, Cole. We have no choice." They'd talked before, she and Cole, and she knew his agony as much as her own. She was his sister, almost his mother, and the boy had shared with her his shame and his secret. That was the ultimate irony. He looked up at her now, looking to her again as the child to the mother. Although he knew now that she was as helpless as he, still he hoped. "Why don't we have a choice? I don't understand." Maris sighed. "It's law, Cole. We don't go against tradition here, you know that. We all have duties put upon us. If we had a choice, I would keep the wings, I would be a flyer, and you could be a singer. We'd both be proud and know we were good at what we did. Life will be hard as a landbound. I want the wings so much. I've had them, and it doesn't seem right that they should be taken from me. But maybe the rightness in it is something I just don't see. People wiser than we decided that things should be the way they are, and maybe I'm just being a child about it, wanting everything my own way." Cole wet his lips, nervous. "No." She looked a question at him. He shook his head stubbornly. "It's not right, Maris. It just isn't. I don't want to fly. I don't want to take your wings. It's all so stupid. I'm hurting you, and I don't want to. But I don't want to hurt Father either. How can I tell him? I'm his heir and all that. I'm supposed to take the wings. He'd hate me. The songs don't say anything about flyers who are scared of the sky like I am. Flyers aren't afraid. I'm not meant for a flyer." His hands were shaking visibly. "Cole, don't worry. It will be all right, really it will. Everyone is frightened at first. I was, too." She wasn't thinking about the lie, only saying words to reassure him. "But it's not fair," he cried. "I don't want to give up my singing, and if I fly, I can't sing. Not like Barion, not like I'd like to. So why are they going to make me, Maris? Why can't you be the flyer like you want to be? Why?" She looked at him so close to crying, and felt like joining him in tears. She didn't have an answer, not for him or for herself. "I don't know," she said, her voice hollow. "I don't know, little one. That is the way things have always been done, though, and that is the way they must be." They stared at each other, both trapped, caught together by a law older than either, and a tradition neither understood. Helpless and hurt, they talked long in the candlelight, saying the same things over and over again, until late they parted for bed. Nothing resolved. But once in bed alone, the resentment came flooding back to Maris, the sense of loss, and with it, shame. She cried herself to sleep that night, and dreamt of purple storm skies that she would never fly.